scheduled to meet with other senior Azerbaijani officials. While Israeli forces continue to kill and injure Palestinian civilians across the Gaza Strip, more than 2 months after the ceasefire agreement with Hamas entered into force, Israeli forces continued their violations of the ceasefire agreement on Sunday, launching attacks on the southern and central parts of the territory. Gaza's medical sources reported at least 6 new fatalities and 17 injuries within 24 hours. The fatalities included a Palestinian child who was killed by Israeli forces' gunfire in the El Mawasi area of Khan Yunis in southern Gaza. Another child was injured by Israeli gunfire in the El Tufah neighborhood of Gaza City. More than 370 civilians have been killed since the ceasefire took effect in October. The death toll from the Israeli genocide since October 2023 has risen to 70,360, leaving more than 171,000 others injured. Israeli forces also demolished buildings and opened fire in areas where they remain stationed east of Khan Yunis, as the regime's artillery shelled areas north of Rafah, also in southern Gaza. Well, now joining us from Deir al-Balah with the latest is our correspondent Ghada Ibrahim. Ghada, thank you very much, as always, for joining us during this hour's top headlines. Ghada, as we continue to say, the death toll continues to rise. Children, women, elderly usually make up the majority of this. And also, as we are accustomed to, unfortunately, that when the Zionist entity kills some of these people, they do actually take their bodies, their remains, in a way to pressure the family, to further torture them. How is all the situation happening there, in addition, of course, to the dire humanitarian situation, Khada?
Yes, exactly. The Gaza Health Ministry announced that at least 373 Palestinians were killed since the beginning of this U.S. brokered ceasefire agreement here in Gaza City in different attacks on the areas not only behind the so-called yellow line, but also in areas outside the so-called yellow line zones. So more attacks are taking place until this moment. More attacks are taking place on the eastern parts of Khan Yunis City in particular, and the focal points of these attacks are happening to be behind the so-called yellow line in the eastern parts of Rafah City, the eastern parts of Khan Yunis, like Al-Qarara, Bani Sahela, and Abasan areas, and also on the eastern parts of Gaza City, Al-Sha'af neighborhood, and also Jabalia and Beit Lahia towns. These attacks are fatal, actually, and they are actually causing more victims among the Palestinians and among the devastated population here in the Gaza Strip, and the majority of these casualties are children and women. The latest of these attacks resulted in one Palestinian child killed that was in Al-Mawasi area near Rafah City, and another woman was also killed as a result of a previous attack after succumbing to her injuries, to the injuries she sustained previously from the eastern parts of Khan Yunis City as well. So every passing day, more people are falling victim to these attacks. More Palestinians are falling victim, not only in as martyrs, but also as injuries. More than 970 people were injured since the beginning of the ceasefire agreement, and the hospitals in Gaza City and also here in the middle area are still overwhelmed by the sheer volume of the casualties and by the sheer volume of the injuries that are coming to the hospitals from the different areas of the Gaza Strip, and particularly from the eastern parts of Gaza City and the eastern parts of Deir al-Balah, the eastern parts of Khan Yunis City as well. So amidst the shortages that the hospitals are experiencing regarding the shortages on fuel, the shortages in medications, medical supplies, they are still overwhelmed by the casualties resulted from the Israeli attacks. So according to the health ministry as well, at least 70 Palestinian children were killed since the beginning of the ceasefire agreement until now. At least one quarter of the casualties were actually women as well. So we are talking about an indiscriminate attacks that are targeting Palestinians in all the areas of their displacement encampments or behind the so-called yellow line. In the western parts of the city, the Israeli occupation regimes or the Israeli occupation army's attacks are continuous, as well as more attacks are taking place in the western parts of Al-Mawasi area, like from the Israeli warships that are continuously attacking the people who are taking shelter in the western parts of Gaza City and the western parts of Al-Mawasi area. This is worth mentioning that these people are living unimaginable humanitarian crisis as a result of lacking all the basics of survival. They are lacking food, they are lacking sheltering materials, and as the cold weather sits in nowadays, their suffering is multiplied because they are lacking the food items, and most importantly, they are lacking the sheltering materials. And this is the third winter after the genocidal war started, and the situation is only deteriorating for them, and it is not getting any better, contrary to their expectations that the ceasefire would bring them the relief they wanted and the relief they have been waiting for since the beginning of the Israeli genocide.
Well, exactly. On that point, as always, I'd like to thank you very much there. Correspondent Ghad Ibrahim joining us from Deir al-Balah. Please stay safe and stay warm. The International Committee of the Red Cross says Israel continues to prevent its teams from visiting Palestinian prisoners, despite growing reports about their deteriorating health conditions. The Red Cross said its teams have been unable to visit Palestinian prisoners in Israel's jails since the Gaza genocide began in October 2023. The Red Cross said it is working to intensify efforts to reach detainees despite the restrictions placed on its operations. Earlier, the Palestinian Commission of Detainees and Ex-Detainees Affairs warned of the critical health conditions of Palestinians held in Israeli jails. Even Israel's own media have corroborated these reports. The Times of Israel has reported severe weight loss, clear signs of malnutrition, and overcrowding in the regime's jails. It also confirmed repeated physical abuse of Palestinians by prison guards. More than 9,300 Palestinians are currently imprisoned by Israel, including women and children. Reports say detainees face torture, abuse, malnutrition, and medical neglect, resulting in the deaths of dozens. Robert Inlakish says conditions for Palestinian abductees, particularly in the occupied West Bank, have worsened since October 2023. Let's hear more.
It's a problem, particularly in the West Bank, which has afflicted a large portion of the male population in specific. But when we're looking at post-October 7, 2023, those conditions have gotten much worse. We're looking now at a situation where these prisoners have been starved, beaten routinely, sexually assaulted, subjected to all sorts of forms of rape, gang rape, get rape with sticks, the use of dogs to do as such to them. So we're looking at very, very extreme cases. And there's around roughly still 11,000 Palestinians who are held by the Israelis in both prison and then as well military detention camps. And the two are actually different. One is the Israeli military system and military courts, which either produces these administrative detainee orders, which is held without a charge orders, or it eventually convicts Palestinians in its kangaroo court system that has a 99.9% conviction rate. But the others are those who were kidnapped and held hostage from Gaza. And these prisoners, or these hostages, are being subjected to some of the worst forms of torture imaginable.
Israeli forces have conducted fresh raids into the Palestinian towns of Alal and Balda in northern Tulkarm region in the occupied West Bank. Our correspondent Nakat Hamad joined us earlier from Ramallah with the latest updates on the ongoing Israeli atrocities across the occupied territory.
Palestinian, a 19-year-old Mu'min Nidal Abu Riash, was announced martyred by the direct killing or by the direct gunshots by the Israeli forces. Last night, the Israeli forces directly shot live ammunition against those three Palestinians, of course, under the pretense of performing a car ramming operation, which the cameras of the surveillance cameras had have clearly denied and showed that the Israeli forces shot those three Palestinians without imposing any threat or danger towards the Israeli forces who were on the village of on the land of the village of Azzoun to the east of occupied Qalqilia. This is actually quite similar to what happened in Al-Khalil, where the Israeli forces also shot two Palestinians under the pretense, under the same pretense of performing a car ramming operation, but they were actually just in the street. One of them was a municipality worker who was just cleaning the street and that shot, and the other was a 17 years old Palestinian child who was trying to reach towards his home. With this announcement of the martyrdom of Mu'min Abu Riash, the total number of the Palestinians killed in the occupied West Bank since October 2023 rises up to more than 1,089 Palestinians that have been killed in the occupied West Bank.
While nationwide rallies have been held in Australia in a show of support for the Palestinian people in Gaza, demonstrators have condemned Israel's violations of the ceasefire in Gaza, urging the Australian government to stop arms deliveries to the regime. Max Javilli reports from Brisbane.
Rallies were held on Sunday in major Australian cities in support of Palestinians in Gaza. The rallies took place under the name "The Genocide Continues." Protesters denounced continued Israeli attacks and restrictions on aid entry into Gaza despite a ceasefire that took effect in early October. In Brisbane, about 1,000 people took to the streets, rejecting a plan proposed by U.S. President Donald Trump to end the Gaza war.
I have family in Gaza, and they're in Jabalia, and they're completely under siege. This peace plan is not a plan for peace. This peace plan is a plan for further occupation and the further annexation of land that is not Israeli land.
Last week, some media revealed that Australia continued to transfer to Israel parts for the F-35 fighter jets and other materials, even on passenger aircraft, until October this year.
Last September, Australia recognized Palestine as a sovereign state, becoming one of more than 150 countries to do so. However, pro-Palestine advocates in Brisbane believe that much more is needed from the Australian government to satisfy its obligations under international law.
It's not enough, but there's also a lot more to happen there. There is recognizing that the genocide has been unfolding in the past 2 years, recognizing that there are approximately 100,000 Palestinians who have been killed. At least 83% of them are civilians and innocent people, and women and children.
More protests in solidarity with the besieged Palestinians are expected to be organized in various Australian cities before Christmas festivities. Max Civili, Brisbane.
In other news, Thailand's military has launched airstrikes along its disputed border with Cambodia after clashes that killed one Thai soldier and wounded four others. Thailand Army spokesman Major General Winhai Suvari has said country's aircraft targeted positions in Chongbuk area in northeastern Thailand following alleged Cambodian fire. He added that the military was expediting evacuation support for civilians in border areas. Meanwhile, Cambodia's defense ministry confirmed the raids in two provinces, saying it had not retaliated. The incident is the latest flare-up since a July ceasefire that ended 5 days of fighting, which left 48 people dead and displaced 300,000 others. Tensions have persisted amid long-standing disputes over the 817-kilometer frontier. The Venezuelan army has sworn in thousands of new soldiers as the United States intensifies military pressure on the oil-rich nation.
In these moments, when imperialism threatens our homeland and our people in an illegal, deceitful, false, and arrogant manner, young people are coming by the thousands to join the Bolivarian National Armed Force, to join the General Directorate of Military Counterintelligence, to join the Presidential Honor Guard.
Some 5,600 new soldiers were sworn in following President Nicolas Maduro's call to expand military recruitment, in the face of Washington's threats of military aggression. Maduro's call came after the U.S. deployed a fleet of warships, including the world's largest aircraft carrier, to the Caribbean, under the pretext of combating drug trafficking. Washington has also carried out deadly strikes on Venezuelan boats at sea, killing more than 80 people. Maduro says the U.S. deployment is aimed at overthrowing him and seizing the country's oil reserves. U.S. President Donald Trump recently threatened Venezuela with an imminent land invasion, once again accusing Caracas of aiding the flow of drugs and migrants into the United States. Well, thank you very much, everyone. Please stay tuned. Goodbye for now.
These are your last breaths, that's why you're struggling so hard. You're so weak, you only fight our children, but you can't even defeat them at all. Unfortunately, you don't have a house anywhere for us to shatter it on your head. But you better run away from our house faster before we bury you right here. Of tunnels to hide from our burning storm. We've dug thousands of tunnels to ambush and hunt you down. This isn't blood in our veins, it is love and it is faith. This isn't the shout in our lips, it's thunder. You never know what you face. With us.
Baluchistan is populated by over 9,000 villages. The village of Ghalanor dates back to the Qajar period, and since this area isn't prone to earthquakes, the adobe houses have managed to survive for about 150 years. Isn't that amazing? About 40 kilometers from the city of Zobol, this village was originally built on top of a hill and witnessed the migration of the villages of Old Fort. In fact, that's where it gets its name, Ghalanor, which means new fort. Ghalanor was built on high ground to protect its occupants from flood, since the varying amount of the flowing water of the Hamul River has always caused different problems for the people living in the Sistan Basin. But that's not the only thing the architects of this village had up their sleeves. During the Qajar period in the 18th and 19th centuries, different regions were managed by overlords or khans. The most eye-catching structure here is the two-story adobe castle of the Khan of the region. It was built at the entrance of the village and around a small hill, so the top of the hill is the floor of the second story. The village is currently being restored and is going to be turned into an eco-tourism village. Two kilometers from Ghalanor lies a mysterious and ancient city referred to over the past 200 to 300 years as Dahaneh Ghulaman, or Gateway of the Slaves. Dahaneh Ghulaman is the largest Achaemenian site in the entire eastern section of Iran that has been dated back to between the 4th and the 6th century BC. More importantly, it's the only Achaemenid site that may hold within its depths the secrets of the lifestyle of the ordinary people living at that time. Built in the wilderness, away from the imperial capital, even with the alignment of buildings roughly in a straight line, running southwest to northeast along the edge of water supplies, the site was only inhabited for a brief period of a century or a century and a half, and was abandoned as a result of natural forces that have always determined the survival and migration of urban settlements in the arid region of Sistan. The entire site was covered by sand. After it was dug up about 50 years ago in the 1960s, the layout of this ancient city was studied extensively by archaeologists from around the world. And it seems that they all came to a similar conclusion. The precise architecture and great harmony in the design of Dahaneh Ghulaman suggest that it was built with urban planning in mind about 2,500 years ago. Geometric studies on this site have revealed 27 major structures and an additional 23 buildings, most of which have not yet been unearthed. It was believed that the Achaemenids used architectural plans only in the construction of palaces and important buildings, such as the royal residences of Pasargadae, Persepolis, Susa, as well as Dasht-e Gohar. But it seems that the people of Dahaneh Ghulaman even prepared an architectural plan for the construction of their alleys and ordinary houses. The urban planning, the architecture, the temple, the location and size of what remains of this ancient city have led scholars to believe that it was a satrapal capital or something very similar to it in character. Studies into the origins of the hearths, fireplaces and altars have tried to reveal their purpose since they have a unique architecture. Were they used for animal sacrifices since animal blood was found on the altars? What kind of rituals were performed here? All these studies have tried to find answers to the many questions that arose 40 years ago with the unearthing of the site and have never been completely answered, even to this day. Standing atop the nearby hill that gives you an overview of the site, you can see lakes filled with a considerable amount of water around it.
The Chaimime reservoirs in the south of Zobol are three big lakes that are the second most important water storage reservoirs in the region.
The water stored in these big lakes is used to irrigate the Sistan Plain and to provide drinking water for the cities of Zabol and Zahedan.
Trees were planted all around the lakes by the University of Zabol to prevent dust from falling into the water. This is Golnar Farnoudi for Iran.
Behind this beautiful old wooden door lies an ancient civilization, a wealth of cultural, artistic, and religious jewels that portray the civilization of a nation.
The Qom Astana Museum, located in the city of Qom, right near the holy shrine of Fatima Masuma, sister of Imam Riza, opened up its doors to the public back in 1935. The museum has an area of 1,000 square meters with two floors hosting two exhibition halls. More than 1,000 artifacts and objects of artistic, cultural, and historical value are displayed here. These treasures belong to different periods in history, from the 1st and 2nd millennium BC to the Islamic era in the country. The museum displays a wide range of objects and artifacts, varying from paintings, chinaware, ceramics and pottery, to priceless handmade rugs, glassware and precious Qurans.
Museum near to the shrine of Fatima Masura. It's wonderful to look around this museum, particularly to look at the carpet, beautiful carpet, and with the silk, beautifully designed. And also, I look around some other places to look at the Quran, the oldest Quran from the 9th century to the present time. It's amazing to keep those kind of like traditional symbolic teachings of Prophet Muhammad.
The crown jewel of Iran's handicraft industry is its beautiful handmade rugs and carpets. Excavations in Iran have revealed that this art dates back to the 1st and 2nd millennium BC. The treasured silk rugs in this museum are valuable for their extraordinary designs, rich combination of colors, and excellent texture. One of the main features of Islamic architecture is the gorgeous glazed tiles that decorate the interior and exterior of the buildings. This art form reached new heights during the 14th century when the Timurid Empire ruled the country. The oldest tiles in this museum belong to the Seljuk era, some 12 centuries ago.
Think beautiful doors opened up to. There must have been a beautiful heaven behind these doors that inspired the artist to create wonders on these beautiful creations.
The decorated doors displayed here date back to different time periods, but all adorned beautifully with different artistic techniques. Some are decorated with the art of marquetry, wood inlaying and wood carving with delicate pieces of ivory, bone, brass, gold and silver sections. Others are made with metal, embellished with inscriptions written by the best calligraphers of the time.
size isn't really an issue when it comes to narrating history. Some items here in this museum are quite small in size, but great and precise narrators that reveal historical facts. Museums are the spiritual and cultural treasures of a nation that clearly display the wisdom, intelligence, and artistic abilities of the past generations. These jewels are ever eternal. Hoda Lezgi for Iran.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.
Doing us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The spotlight.
Welcome, everyone. For decades, FIFA has hidden behind a cloak of neutrality. Keep politics out of football, they've said, while fining players for messages of solidarity and silencing protests for justice. But now, the mask has slipped. In a stunning act of hypocrisy, FIFA President Gianni Infantino has awarded his inaugural Peace Prize to Donald Trump, president of bombs, borders, and bigotry. The same organization that punishes a player for a slogan rewards a man who calls entire nations garbage, who fuels genocide, and whose legacy is one of global division. And the double standards don't stop there. While FIFA moved with lightning speed to ban Russia for what it considered the invasion of Ukraine, it has for years refused to even debate suspending Israel as it wages a documented genocide on Palestine. So what is FIFA's true game? Is it a guardian of sport or a political arm of American empire and its allies? In this Spotlight episode, we're not here to play games. We're here to expose them. But first, let's get more details in this report.
Players frequently face fines and bans from FIFA for expressing political messages, as the football governing body has long championed a policy of political neutrality. Yet on Friday, FIFA President Gianni Infantino awarded the inaugural FIFA Peace Prize to U.S. President Donald Trump. While presenting the prize, Infantino expressed support for Trump's international deals, including the so-called Abraham Accords that established formal ties between Israel and several Arab states without resolving the question of Palestinian statehood. Infantino had previously warned against using football to stoke division, saying that the political neutrality of sports should be protected. 2 years later, critics point out that he created a prize to celebrate peace and unity and then handed it to a president who called people from Somalia garbage just days prior and has advocated for increased military spending across the Western world. Trump also ordered the bombing of Iran's nuclear facilities in June and continues to arm Israel despite the ongoing genocide against Palestinians. Trump's administration has also carried out airstrikes against vessels near Venezuela. At home, the U.S. president has intensified an anti-immigration crackdown that has led to the detention and attempted deportation of non-citizens. Some advocates have been targeted for their criticism of Israel. A group of international activists who campaigned for suspending Israel from the world football have released a statement calling the award to Trump a shameful development. They also accused FIFA and UEFA of double standards over their failure to act against Israel in the 2 years of its war on Gaza, while swiftly sanctioning Russia following the breakout of the war in Ukraine in 2022. Infantino has refused to take action against Israel, arguing that football cannot solve geopolitical issues. The apparent preferential treatment of Israel calls into question the integrity of FIFA's supposed commitment to political neutrality, as FIFA continues to tout football as a unifying force on the global stage. It must now confront mounting accusations of hypocrisy and double standards that threaten its credibility.
Well, today we are joined by Mr. Ashish Prashad, political analyst and former West Asia Peace Envoy Advisor from New York. And Ms. Leila Hatoum, editor-in-chief of MENA Uncensored, joining us from Beirut. Well, I'd like to thank both of you for joining us during this episode of Spotlight. Well, let's go ahead and start off with our own coin toss, shall we? First of all, Ms. Hatoum, let's go ahead and start off with you. I mean, this Trump award. How can FIFA even claim this, quote, political neutrality is sacred, while creating a political prize and handing it to one of the most disruptive, narcissistic, ignorant, and racist political figures on earth today? And just by the way, for our viewers, these are the exact terms and adjectives that Americans, his own people, describe him as.
I'm not surprised at all when it comes to this move by FIFA. At the end of the day, all of the international organizations are shooting themselves in the foot one after the other, exposing themselves, and the masks are off. FIFA is the most recent one only. I mean, if you had any doubt, the IAEA before it, the United Nations, you name it. Every single entity across the world that is headed by somebody who's appointed by one of the big five countries, then you have to think about it this way. They are at any point followers of one of those big five countries or all of them. And at the same time, they have to humor the Israeli occupation because the Zionist global lobby is very strong and it controls everybody, be it through the scandals they have on them or other secrets. When it comes to Infantino, whom we just basically naturalized as a Lebanese citizen because he's married to a Lebanese lady just recently, you have to understand one thing. This guy is, at the end of the day, a salesman. And he wants to actually, what you call, stay in power. The best way to do it is to have a network. So he's working as a marketing person. When it comes to Donald Trump, again, this person is the one who controls all the keys at the moment, a crazy person who controls the world. So at the end of the day, FIFA, which has so much bigotry against the countries that the Americans are enemies with, or the Israelis are enemies with, then that's basically where you see FIFA distancing itself or basically approaching. When it comes to Russia, they were really, really fast in suspending its team. When it comes to the Israeli entity, they don't see, they don't hear, they don't say anything. And when it comes to the Americans, they will always kiss the hands and feet of the Americans.
Well, definitely, Ms. Hatoum, we're going to be elaborating a bit on that specific point later in today's program. Mr. Prashad, I'd like to go ahead and move over to you. I mean, if a player took a knee against Trump's policies or even wore a shirt criticizing his immigration crackdown, they'd be fined. What message does this specific crowning of him with a Peace Prize actually send to its own players when FIFA's honoring a president who not only embodies these characteristics but also has even mocked some of their home countries, such as those from African nations?
Look, I mean, it's, you know, firstly, thank you for having me. This is a truly shameful development, but it's not a surprise. I mean, Gianni Infantino for the entire year has been used by this White House to normalize their atrocities. Remember that, right? The biggest way to normalize atrocities, the biggest way to normalize the behavior of bad, good, whatever, of a nation, of individuals, of people, is to participate in cultural items, right? You recently covered Eurovision. Obviously, football is the biggest sport in the world. And the White House has, you know, knowing that this World Cup was coming to the United States, has drawn in what my colleague Leila pointed out, a marketing guy who is nothing, wants the spotlight himself, frankly, as well. They've drawn in this individual to help them normalize the genocide in Gaza, to help them normalize this fake peace plan, to help them normalize any ceasefire, and normalize all the actions they've got taken forward. Look, many FIFA members, by the way, in South America, that, you know, one of the biggest regions for football, might be attacked by this president between now and the next World Cup. What is FIFA going to do about that? Nothing. Because Gianni Infantino is aligning himself with this president and his political views just so he can share his spotlight. Now, you ask, what does it say to the people that, you know, people can't sit there, go down on one knee or protest the raids that are going on? Look, this has been America from day one, right? You and me know that. Like, it's just pigeoned differently, right? Whether it's Biden or Trump, a foreign policy, domestic policy, they've tried to always separate culture from actual change because they know the power that culture can bring. That's why they crack down so hard. And I'll give you another example because people are going to go hard at Trump. President Obama, during the BLM uprisings in 2020, could have changed the course of the country when he wasn't in office. The NBA were looking to him to ask him for his permission to strike, for his permission that black people wouldn't work or be entertainment for the white population during the BLM thing. And he told them not to strike. Remember that. This is consistent from all American presidents when it comes down to it. Some will not crack down publicly, but they will privately shut down any cultural revolutionary spirits that athletes have, that countries have, that other individuals have.
Well, Mr. Prashar, I'd like to thank you for pointing that out to our viewers who continuously need to be reminded sometimes about what history has shown us, and we don't want to just focus on today. Ms. Hatoum, let me move over back to you, and let's, of course, bring in Israel, the double standards and the geopolitics. Now, again, this is something we always have to pop up in any discussion. FIFA statutes prohibits the membership for entities that are not independent. Given Israel's control over movement, the infrastructure, and even the lives of the Palestinian footballers, how can the Israel Football Association even be considered independent?
Well, they're not independent. I mean, if you actually want to implement international law, the Israeli entity itself is not a state. It's still an entity because it doesn't have fixed borders. So technically, under international law, it's not a state. It's not independent at any point. They are a force of occupation. The place or the region is still under basically multiple what you call frictions and back and forth when it comes to wars. So if they want to implement international law on one side and not on the other, that clearly shows their double standards. That's one. The other thing, not suspending their team is another double standard versus basically the Russians whom they suspended directly. So if I look at the whole situation, I see a very corrupt group. And this is not the first thing that actually catches my eye. I mean, if you remember, FIFA was marred by all these scandals when it comes to taking bribes from Qatar, from other countries, when it comes to voting to certain members or appointing certain members. And some of them actually stuck to its leadership and its members. So at the end of the day, when you have a corrupt bunch ruling one of the highest bodies when it comes to the most popular sport in the world, one of the most popular sports in the world, that tells you a lot of things. They can be bought, they can be actually threatened with scandals, and they will have to implement double standards based on who holds their cards.
Well, exactly. Mr. Prashar, I do want to come over to you. Ms. Leila Hatoum did mention something for the second time. She mentioned Russia. And just a reminder of you from something we had put in our report, that in 2022, just 3 years ago, FIFA instantly removed Russia from the competition. The principle was clear. A member committing a severe breach of international law cannot use football as a platform. Now, this is their own wordings. This is their own statement. Why does this principle not apply again to Israel? Infantino himself says, quote, football cannot solve geopolitical issues. But wasn't banning Russia precisely an attempt to respond to such a geopolitical issue? I mean, isn't that considered picking a side, basically?
Well, there's so many questions there. I want to answer them all individually. So firstly, actually, FIFA and UEFA are pretty consistent. They didn't want to ban Russia. I want to make sure everyone understands this. 12 European countries, and this is where geopolitics does cut into this, led by Sweden and Poland, on the second day of Russia's invasion, when there was no clear war crimes, when there was just an invasion at that point, they called UEFA and FIFA and said they would boycott football. Now, as you know, Europe is the biggest moneymaker on football. 12 European nations, and they guaranteed another 6 were going to join, would basically shut down the global game, in essence. And they forced UEFA and FIFA into a position where they could make those statements, where they're saying, we're going to take this moral stand against Russia. But Infantino and Seferin didn't want to do that at that point. They only did this under the pressure of European governments, European sanctions, and European football federations that had a moral backbone for 5 minutes to do that. And the double standard, actually, is those same European federations, some who, by the way, say this in solidarity with Palestine, Ireland, Spain, Italy, countries like that, who basically abandoned Palestine here in this sense, right? Their public, their fans were threatening to boycott football, something that people do not do all the time. It is the global game. It is the number one sport in the world. Yet they were willing to do that for Russia, and they haven't done an ounce of that. And these are also, in Spain's case, a lot of good talk. A prime minister who says a lot of good things on TV. But if he boycotted football, think about that. They are the number one nation in the world with the best player in the world. Most people going to the World Cup want to see them, Argentina, Brazil. If they said they would boycott football tomorrow, FIFA would suspend Israel. If they said they'd boycott football tomorrow, they'd be out of the Champions League and out of UEFA overnight. They make so much money for UEFA. Now, answering the second point about that, geopolitics, sport has always been at the pinnacle of changing the world in geopolitics. Think about this, right? After World War II, the first things we not just hold Germany accountable in Nuremberg and other war crime tribunals, but we banned them from international sport for 6 years. Nazi Germany and Germany, West and East, were banned for 6 years until the 1954 World Cup. Closer to home in Europe, Yugoslavia, during the Balkan War, was suspended from football and international competition. A war, by the way, that the UEFA president was personally involved in. He volunteered for the Slovenian army and witnessed atrocities, witnessed massacres of Bosnians, and has spoken about that repeatedly, about how culture had an impact. So the hypocrisy is really there, because they're trying to remove football and other sport from geopolitics and politics, because it's become such a big business. Historically, sport has been at the forefront of isolating nations, committing war crimes, and punishing them and holding them accountable when they've committed crimes against humanity, like genocide, like apartheid, and the most popular, the biggest example is apartheid South Africa, where it isolated a nation and eventually brought it down.
Well, Mr. Prashar, I do, if you could please briefly answer your own question. You were saying how the human rights experts and people have been demanding and urging the boycotting of the Israeli football. Specifically, we have the 2026 Football World Cup coming up. Do you think that will happen? Why yes or no? Why?
Well, so look, as you guys know, as you've covered, we launched a campaign with Richard Falk, Craig McIver, other former UN High Commissioners, called Game Over Israel. And we never focused on FIFA. We have no intention of trying to get them thrown out of FIFA. The reality is, if you want to end Israeli football, you need to get them thrown out of UEFA. And I'll tell you why. Fundamentally, like Leila said, like you have introed, there's no way FIFA are going to kick Israel out of football. Fundamentally, because they're aligned with U.S. foreign policy, and Gianni Infantino is so bent that everybody knows it at this point, right? He was actually Israel's pick for the job. UEFA, on the other hand, is where Israel plays 90% of its football. They play in the Champions League, the Europa League, the Conference League. Israel's federation is housed within UEFA, which is ironic given they're a Middle East nation. But also, their international competitions, the Nations League, the European Championships, that is where they make all their money. And here's the kicker. They also get a subsidy from UEFA to keep the league running. Because unlike the Premier League and La Liga, and this is not just a knock on the Israeli league. Like, no one watches Hungarian football internationally. No one watches Polish football. They get a subsidy from the big leagues who survive. And what we're trying to do with Game Over Israel, and what we think we will achieve in January, is UEFA actually suspending Israel, because we have run this campaign since September, and it's clear that Israel has no intention of following this fake peace plan that Donald Trump has. But also, legally, we are taking them to court in Switzerland where they're in breach of international law because they've actually encroached on Asian football territory by having occupied teams in the occupied territory participating in the Israeli Football League. Secondly, and this is good, unfortunately, it always comes down to money. UEFA only get a tax exemption in Switzerland if they continue to promote peace. Now, figure that. You get a tax exemption if you promote peace. Now, while Israel participates under the UEFA banner and has teams in the occupied territory, they're in breach of their own tax exemption. And that is what we're going after.
Very interesting. Getting a tax when you promote peace, protesting at peace, and you get detained and arrested. There's so many things going on in this world. It's become insane. Ms. Hatoun, let's go ahead and take it a bit step further. I mean, the Palestinian footballers on the ground, they have been killed. Their stadiums have been damaged. Traveling just for matches has been made basically impossible. At what point can FIFA's inaction actually become complicity in this destruction and genocide?
Oh, it has been complicit since long time ago. I mean, remember, like, the whole attack against Palestinian footballers didn't start 2 years ago with this war, October 7, 2023, until today. It started way before when the Israeli snipers were targeting the knees of Palestinian footballers on the ground, be it in Gaza or the West Bank. They were targeting future footballers when they were shooting little children in their knees as well. So at the end of the day, when you look at the whole situation, the Israeli occupation was practicing the act of taking out future football players and current football players at that time through sniping their knees. And FIFA didn't do anything. There were lots of complaints that were lodged, even by the PA itself. And PA is like, it lacks action at most of the time. And the FIFA and UEFA and anybody else, they didn't move. And I disagree with our colleague over here when it comes to possible action being taken in January. I don't see the Spaniards moving. The Spaniards actually promised to protect the flotilla at one point or another, and they actually didn't send their own navy to protect the flotilla. The Spaniards could have easily lodged a complaint to UEFA, and the La Liga is one of the biggest in UEFA, in Europe's basically federation for football, and they haven't done anything. The Italians, they're not going to do anything, and the Italian league is very big. When it comes to the French league is very big. They're not going to do any action against the Israelis. So who's left? The Irish are going to move anything? The Germans? I highly doubt that the Germans are going to take action. The Nazi Germany today basically supports the Zionist Israeli entity. That's why I call them the Zionazis and the Nazi Zionists. So at the end of the day, I highly doubt that there will be any action on a collective level from UEFA, but possibly from smaller countries within Europe, they could basically threaten and basically boycott playing games with the Israelis. I do bet that UEFA is going to actually implement fines on them and call them anti-Semitic itself.
Well, on that, we have a few more minutes left. I would like to go ahead and cross back over to Mr. Prashar. Mr. Prashar, I mean, ultimately, who is FIFA for? Is it for the global majority of players and fans who actually gather from around the world, no matter your nationality, no matter your culture, no matter your religion, just to sit, to enjoy a good match? Or has it actually become for the politicians, for the corporations it now so openly serves?
Firstly, I want to say I agree with Leila. I think football could have done something like they did for Russia. So I don't disagree. Spain, Italy, no, they're not going to do what they did against Russia. But What I want to say is that, unfortunately, because nobody's going to do anything, it is down to football fans, and it is down to the legal action and other things other people are taking behind the scenes right now to push UEFA over the edge. But FIFA's gone from the public. The game is gone. The game doesn't belong to the people anymore. Unfortunately, look, there is ways that the public can reclaim the game, right, and show their power, right? You're already seeing across Europe people protesting, demonstrating, showing tifos and banners in behalf of Palestine, everywhere from Istanbul to Paris to even in Germany, frankly, and they've been cracked down upon, but they still keep going. But the game, FIFA does, as an institution, is lost to the public at this point. It hasn't been that way since, I would go as far back as the 94 World Cup. The irony of that, the last time the Americans held the World Cup, was the beginning of the corporate decline of FIFA as an institution. After that, it became, you know, the home of politicians and Coca-Cola. And it will continue to go down that path unless the fans, frankly, reclaim the game and take this monstrosity back. But we see no willpower in people giving up the one, what I call their one escape from their normal life. That's the sad truth about it, especially for Westerners. They go to this game to vent. They go go to this game to like escape from life sometimes, right? You think about conditions that people live in. I mean, you mentioned it, you know, even in the UK, you know, the quality of life right now is not great. And people go to a Liverpool game to escape that. Do you see them giving it up for a week or 2 weeks to change and can take back some power in football? No, FIFA is going to continue down the Americanization of this sport, similar to the NFL, similar to basketball, where it's become less about the fans, their experience, their relationship with the pitch and the game, and more about how much money they can rake in. Just look at the ticket prices. Some basic World Cup final ticket prices are $7,000. And there's no guarantee that even if you pay that, you won't be arrested, detained, and deported by ICE if you go to the United States.
Well, on that point, it seems I'm afraid we have run out of time. I'd like to thank both of our guests for joining us during this very interesting topic that definitely needs to be talked about more often. First of all, from New York, Mr. Ashish Prashar, political analyst and former West Asia Peace Envoy Advisor. And, of course, as always, from Beirut, Ms. Leila Hatoum, Editor-in-Chief of MENA Uncensored. A pleasure to have you both. Until next time, goodbye.